From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is the first time since the Spanish conquests, 500 years, that there has been real moves towards integration in South America. The country's been very separated from one another. And integration is going to be a prerequisite for authentic independence.
From Bolivia to Baghdad, today MIT professor Noam Chomsky on what's next, creating another world in a time of war, empire, and devastation. Then Iroquois leader and scholar John Mohawk has died at the age of 61. He recently spoke at a forum on indigenous peoples' resistance to economic globalization. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Midtown Manhattan. Former CIA Director Robert Gates has been sworn in as the country's new Secretary of Defense, replacing Donald Rumsfeld. On Monday, Gates issued a grim warning about Iraq.
All of us want to find a way to bring America's sons and daughters home again. But as the President has made clear, we simply cannot afford to fail in the Middle East. Failure in Iraq at this juncture would be a calamity that would haunt our nation, impair our credibility, and endanger Americans for decades to come.
As Robert Gates was being sworn in, a new Pentagon report revealed attacks against American and Iraqi targets are at their highest level ever. Between August and November, American and Iraqi targets were attacked an average of 660 times a week. But experts say even that figure may be a gross underestimate. The Iraq Study Group report concluded the government is significantly underreporting violence in Iraq. The panel complained most attacks that failed to hurt U.S. troops are simply left out of the Pentagon's calculations. The Iraq Study Group found on one day in July 2006, there were 93 attacks or significant acts of violence reported, yet a careful review of the reports for that single day brought to light 1,100 acts of violence. The Joint Chiefs of Staff are unanimously opposing a White House plan to send up to 30,000 more troops to Iraq. According to the Washington Post, top Pentagon officials have warned President Bush a short-term troop increase could give a boost to virtually all the armed factions in Iraq without strengthening the positions of the U.S. military or Iraq's security forces in the long term. Meanwhile, the top Democrat in the Senate has said he would support President Bush's call for sending thousands of more troops to Iraq. Incoming Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid spoke Sunday on ABC's This Week.
If it's for a surge, that is for 2 or 3 months, and it's part of a program to get us out of there, as indicated by this time next year, then sure, I'll go along with it. But if
Meanwhile, former Secretary of State General Colin Powell has said he opposes the idea of sending any more troops to Iraq. He also admitted the U.S. is losing the war in Iraq.
So if it's grave and deteriorating and we're not winning, we are losing. We haven't lost. And this is the time now to start to put in place the kinds of strategies that will turn this situation around.
Colin Powell spoke on CBS's Face the Nation. The Iraqi equivalent of the Red Cross has halted its operations in Baghdad following the kidnapping of dozens of people from its office. Gunmen wearing Iraqi army uniforms stormed the Iraqi Red Crescent building Sunday. 16 workers from the aid group are still being held. A day before the mass kidnapping occurred, a senior official at the Red Crescent said harassment from U.S. forces is the greatest threat to the organization's work. In other Iraq news, leaders of the Iraq labor movement have criticized government plans to privatize the country's oil production. The Iraqi government has drafted a law that would allow multinational oil companies to develop Iraq's oil reserves for the first time ever. In the Palestinian territories, at least 3 people have died in renewed fighting between members of Hamas and Fatah. Dozens more have been wounded in a series of gun battles. Fighting has been escalating since Saturday, when Fatah leaders and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called for new elections. The Hamas government rejected the proposal, accusing Abbas of trying to stage a coup. A former Bush administration official is accusing the White House of trying to silence him from criticizing the president's policy on Iran. Former National Security Council official Flint Leverett recently drafted an op-ed intended for the New York Times on Iran. The CIA cleared the article, but then the White House blocked its publication. According to Leverett, the White House is demanding He removed entire paragraphs that detail publicly known information about how Iran cooperated with the United States in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks and how Iran offered to negotiate a comprehensive grand bargain with the United States 3 years ago. Leverett accused White House officials of using fraudulent charges, of revealing classified information to keep critical views from being heard. Leverett said, quote, "Their conduct in this matter is despicable and un-American in the profoundest sense of that term." Leverett is the former senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council and a former senior analyst at the CIA. In death penalty news, Florida has suspended all executions, and California has temporarily stopped using lethal injections to execute death row prisoners. In California, a federal judge ruled it's unconstitutional to kill prisoners in a manner that inflicts unacceptable levels of pain. Florida made its decision following the recent botched execution of Angel Diaz. He remained alive for 34 minutes after the execution began. He died only after prison officials gave him a second dose of lethal chemicals. Meanwhile, a new report from the Death Penalty Information Center has found a total of 53 prisoners have been executed so far this year. It marks the lowest total in a decade. 10 members of Congress visited Havana this weekend and called on the Bush administration to lift the economic embargo of Cuba. The visit marked the largest U.S. legislative mission to travel to Havana since the Cuban Revolution. Republican Congressmember Jeff Flake of Arizona urged the Bush administration to hold talks with Raul Castro.
At a time when Cuba is changing and the opportunities to advance our interests and values in Cuba are not known, we unanimously believe, the 10 of us, that the United States should respond positively to the proposal made by Raul Castro in a speech of December 2nd.
The lawmakers were also told Fidel Castro does not have cancer and that he's not dying. In Mexico, the government has released 42 protesters who were rounded up following a large demonstration in Oaxaca 2 weeks ago. Scores of other protesters remain in jail, including Flavio Sosa, a leader of APO, the Popular Assembly of the Peoples of Oaxaca. A school teacher named Aurelia Juarez was among the protesters released. Juarez said the protesters were beaten in jail. They were pulled by their hair, hit and kicked in their stomachs. She said they were lucky to be out of the prison. Meanwhile, the federal police have begun withdrawing from the center of Oaxaca. They were sent there 7 weeks ago to crush the popular uprising led by the striking teachers and APO. The Financial Times is reporting the U.S. Army is considering measures to force striking workers back to their jobs at Goodyear Tire and Rubber Plant in Kansas. 17,000 members of the United Steelworkers have been on strike at 16 Goodyear plants since October 5th. They're seeking greater job security and continued health care after they retire. The military relies on a plant in Kansas to make tires for Humvee trucks and other equipment used in Iraq and Afghanistan. According to Duncan Hunter, outgoing chair of the House Armed Services Committee, the strike has cut output of Humvee tires by about 35%. On Saturday, solidarity actions were held in support of the striking workers in over 100 cities around the United States and Canada. The Independent of London is reporting the British government's case for going to war in Iraq has been torn apart by the publication of previously suppressed evidence that Tony Blair lied over Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. Britain's key negotiator at the UN testified privately that Blair knew Iraq possessed no weapons of mass destruction. The official, Karn Ross, told an official inquiry that at no time did the British government believe that Iraq's WMD capability actually posed a threat to British interests and that any threat by Saddam Hussein had been, quote, effectively contained. The British Foreign Office had attempted to prevent the testimony of Ross from being made public. Researchers at Harvard University are accusing the United States of using its foreign aid budget to bribe countries which have a vote in the United Nations Security Council. A detailed analysis of 50 years of data has revealed the U.S. gives nations nearly 60% more cash in years when they have a seat. Much of the money is channeled through the U.N.'s Children's Fund, UNICEF, which the U.S. has traditionally controlled. The current head of UNICEF is Ann Veneman, President Bush's former agriculture secretary. The U.S. military has subpoenaed an independent journalist and demand that she testify in the first trial of Lieutenant Aaron Watada, who's refused to serve in Iraq. The journalist, Sarah Olson of Oakland, interviewed Watada in May. She was subpoenaed Thursday. Independent journalist Dar Jamal, Truthout editor Mark Ash, and a reporter with the Honolulu Star Bulletin have also been approached by the military. Watada has been charged with refusing to deploy, contempt toward officials, and conduct unbecoming an officer. His court-martial is set to take place in February. On Saturday, tens of thousands of people marched down Fifth Avenue in Manhattan to protest the police killing of Sean Bell. The Reverend Al Sharpton led the Shopping for Justice march, which went through the heart of the city's shopping district. Sean Bell's father called for a special prosecutor to oversee the investigation and for Police Commissioner Ray Kelly to resign. Marchers included Harry Belafonte, Congressmember Charles Rangel, and police brutality victim Abner Louima, as well as family members of the shooting victims. Saturday marked the fourth birthday of Sean Bell's daughter, Jada. Sean Bell was killed on his wedding day when police fired 50 shots at the car carrying him and his two friends. All three men were unarmed. At Saturday's protest, Democracy Now! Caught up with two young students with the Schomburg Center's Junior Scholars Program.
I'm really happy to see a lot of younger people out here instead of just the older ones protesting about the rally.
I'm happy that the people are out here to help Sean Bell. He's dead. We all cheer for him.
If he was back alive, we would be cheering even though he's alive.
So I'm thankful for God and what he's doing. Amen.
And if it's a damn to us, I bet Sean Bell would be out here right now protesting.
Student journalists Ben Thomas and Trent Stewart, they were both interviewing participants in the march for the Radio Schomburg program. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we bring you world-renowned scholar and linguist Noam Chomsky, who spoke a few days ago at an event sponsored by Massachusetts Global Action. The speech was called What's Next? Creating Another World in a Time of War, Empire, and Devastation. It was held at the Emanuel Church in Boston. Chomsky is professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He recently returned from Latin America. He talked about the recent elections in the region, which have brought leftist governments to power that are challenging U.S. foreign policy. Chomsky also talked about Iraq and Iran in the context of Latin America. In this excerpt, he begins by analyzing the recently released Iraq Study Group report that was chaired by the former Secretary of State, James Baker.
There are efforts to try to extricate the U.S. from the U.S. power, doesn't matter much to the people, but U.S. power from the catastrophes it's created for itself. The most recent such effort, right on the front pages now, so I'll keep to that one, is the Baker-Hamilton report, the Iraq Study Group report, which has some interesting features, very interesting. For example, one of its features, it doesn't have much in the way of proposals, but the feature, the thinking is interesting. So here's one paragraph, refers to recent polls in Iraq. The U.S. government and polling agencies here take regular polls in Iraq. They care a lot about Iraqi opinion. And this points out that recent polling indicates that 79% of Iraqis have a mostly negative view of the influence that the United States has in their country. And 61% of Iraqis, that includes Kurds, approve of attacks on U.S.-led forces. Well, that's clearly a problem. And we have to deal with that problem by changing tactics so they'll understand that we really love them and we're trying to help them, and they'll stop thinking they ought to attack us and hating us and so on. Okay, that was the proposal. There's something missing. The same polls that they cited have some other information. For example, that two-thirds of the people of Baghdad want U.S. troops out immediately, and over three-quarters of the whole population, including Kurds again, wants a firm timetable for withdrawal within a year or less. Well, that isn't mentioned, because in our mission to bring democracy to the world, we don't care about the opinions of people. They're kind of irrelevant. So that isn't mentioned. And, of course, there's no timetable for withdrawal. That's one of the options they rejected. Also interesting is that the American people are treated the same way. A majority of people here are in favor of a firm timetable for withdrawal. But that's irrelevant, too. In fact, back as far as April 2003, a considerable majority of people here in the United States were in favor of keeping U.S. troops there only if they were under U.N. supervision. The U.N. ought to take responsibility for security, for economic development, reconstruction, for democratic development, and so on. But that opinion was, of course, totally ignored and, to my knowledge, not even reported. That continues. That attitude continues. The next big problem next to Iraq is Iran. And the Baker-Hamilton Commission, as you know, gave a recommendation about that. It said the U.S. must somehow engage Iran. But they said that that's going to be problematic given the state of U.S.-Iranian relationships. Well, the U.S. population has an opinion about that, too. 75% of the population here, including a majority of Republicans, think that the United States ought to keep to diplomatic, peaceful measures in engagement with Iran, which they approve of, and not use military threats. Exact opposite of the policy. The same attitudes are true of the people of the region. They don't like Iran, and they don't certainly like armed Iran. But a majority of the population of the regional states favors a nuclear-armed Iran to any form of military intervention, just as people here do. Well, that's kind of irrelevant, so that's also not mentioned in the report. Third interesting fact about the report is that it says the United States cannot achieve its goals in the Middle East, of course, taken for granted that it must achieve those goals. Doesn't mean the people of the United States, means the government and their constituency. The United States cannot achieve its goals in the Middle East unless it deals directly with the Arab-Israeli conflict. And then goes on to say that the U.S. must encourage discussions and so on, but restricting and allowing Palestinians to participate, but only those who accept Israel's right to exist. Okay, those are the only Palestinians who can participate. What about Israelis who accept Palestine's right to exist? Well, no point mentioning them because there probably aren't any. And in fact, there shouldn't be any. No state has a right to exist. It's obvious. In fact, the whole concept, right to exist, as far as I'm aware, it's a good research project for someone. To my knowledge, that concept was created in the 1970s when the Arab states and the PLO formally accepted, PLO tacitly, the Arab states formally, the major ones, formally accepted Israel's right to exist within secure and recognized borders, borrowing the wording of the major UN resolution, UN 242. So it became necessary to raise the barrier to prevent negotiations and diplomacy and to allow expansion instead. And here comes right to exist, which of course nobody's going to accept. It means accepting not only the fact of the expulsion of Palestinians, but also its legitimacy. No state in the world is ever going to accept that, any more than Mexico accepts it recognizes the United States, but it does not recognize the legitimacy of the U.S. conquest of half of Mexico. It's outlandish. But even if we reduce it from the crazy notion of right to exist to just recognizing Palestine, recognizing Israel? Suppose we limit Palestinians to those who recognize Israel. Which Israelis recognize Palestine? Does the United States recognize Palestine? I mean, I won't run through the history here, but for 30 years, the U.S. and Israel have, with rare exceptions, been unilaterally preventing the establishment of a broad international consensus on a two-state settlement. I mean, they're willing now, in the last couple of years, only the last couple of years, to accept a very truncated Palestine that's dismembered, surrounded, no chance of viable existence. Maybe they'll recognize that. A couple of Bantustans, but not any viable state.
We are watching and listening to Noam Chomsky giving an address last week in Boston. We come back. We'll turn to the segment of his speech where he talks about Latin America, from which he just returned. Stay with us. Muslim Gauze here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on NPR and Pacifica stations, low power FM and public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV Channel 375. We're also broadcasting our headlines in Spanish to radio stations around the world. We are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we return now to Noam Chomsky, who spoke a few days ago in Boston.
I'll start with last weekend, important city in South America, Cochabamba, with quite a history. There was a meeting last weekend in Cochabamba in Bolivia of all the South American leaders. It was a very important meeting. One index of its importance is that it was unreported, virtually unreported, apart from the wire services, so every editor knew about it, since I suspect you didn't read that wire service report. I'll read you a few things from it to indicate why it was so important. Last Saturday, the South American leaders agreed to create a high-level commission to study the idea of forming a continent-wide community similar to the European Union. This is the presidents and envoys of all the nations, and there was the two-day summit of the what's called the South American Community of Nations, hosted by Evo Morales in Cochabamba, president of Bolivia. The leaders, reading just now, agreed to form a study group to look at the possibility of creating a continent-wide union and even a South American parliament. The result, according to the, I'm reading from the AP report, the result left fiery Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, long an agitator for the region taking a greater role on the world stage, pleased but impatient, normal stance. They went on, goes on to say that the discussion over South American unity will continue later this month when Mercosur, South American Trading Bloc, has its regular meeting. That'll include leaders from Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, Paraguay, and Uruguay. There has been one point of hostility in South America. That's Peru, Venezuela. But it points out that Chavez and Peruvian President Alan Garcia took advantage of the summit to bury the hatchet after having exchanged insults earlier in the year. And that was the only real conflict in South America, so that seems to have been smoothed over. The new Ecuadorian president, Rafael Correa, proposed a land and river trade route linking the Brazilian Amazon rainforest to Ecuador's Pacific coast, suggesting that for South America it could be kind of like an alternative to the Panama Canal. Chavez and Morales celebrated a new joint project, a gas separation plant in Bolivia's rich, gas-rich region. It's a joint venture with PDVSA, the Venezuelan oil company, and the Bolivian state energy company. And it continues. The Venezuela, as I'm sure you know, is the only, which points out, is the only Latin American member of OPEC and has by far the largest proven oil reserves outside the Middle East, by some measures maybe even comparable to Saudi Arabia. Well, that's very important in the general global context. I'll return to a couple of words about that. There were also contributions, constructive, interesting contributions by Lula da Silva, Brazil's president, Bachelet of Chile, and others. All of this is extremely important. This is the first time since the Spanish conquests, 500 years, that there has been real moves towards integration in South America. The country's been very separated from one another. And integration is going to be a prerequisite for authentic independence. There have been, I'm sure you know, attempts at independence, but they've been crushed, often very violently, partly because of lack of regional support, because there was very little regional cooperation, so you can pick them off one by one. That's what happened since the 1960s. The Kennedy administration orchestrated a coup in Brazil, the first of the, which happened right after the assassination, but was already planned. It was the first of a series of falling dominoes. Neo-Nazi-style national security states spread right across the hemisphere. Chile was one of them, but only one. Finally ended up with reaching Central America with Reagan's terrorist wars in the 1980s, which devastated Central America. Similar things happening in the Caribbean. But that was sort of a one-by-one operation of destroying one country after another, and had the expected domino effect. It's the worst plague of repression in the history of Latin America since the original conquests, which were horrendous. It's only beginning to be understood how horrendous they were. But integration does lay the basis for potential independence, and that's of extreme significance. The colonial history, Spain, Europe, the United States, not only divided countries from one another, but it also left a sharp internal division within the countries, every one, between a very wealthy, small elite and a huge mass of impoverished people. And it was the correlation to race is fairly close. Typically, the rich elite was white, European, westernized, and the poor mass of the population was indigenous, Indian, black, intermingled, and so on. It's a fairly close correlation, and it continues right till the present. The white, mostly white elites who ran the countries were not integrated with had very few interrelations with the other countries of the region. They were Western-oriented. You can see that in all sorts of ways. That's where the capital was exported. That's where the second homes were, where the children went to the universities, where their cultural connections were, and so on. And they had very little responsibility in their own societies. So a very sharp division. They were also very support. You can see it, for example, in imports are mostly luxury goods, overwhelmingly. Development, such as it was mostly foreign. It was much more open, Latin America, much more open to foreign investment than, say, East Asia. It's part of the reason for their different paths of development in the past, radically different paths of development in the last couple of decades. And of course, the elite elements were very strongly sympathetic to the neoliberal programs of the last 25 years, which enriched them, destroyed the countries, but enriched them. Latin America, more than any region in the world outside of Southern Africa, adhered rigorously to the so-called Washington Consensus, what's called outside the United States, the neoliberal programs of roughly the past 25, 30 years. And everywhere where they were rigorously applied, they led to a disaster. There's scarcely an exception. Very striking correlation. Sharp reduction in rates of growth, other macroeconomic indices, all the social effects that go along with that. Actually, the comparison to East Asia is very striking. Latin America is a potentially much richer area. I mean, a century ago, it was taken for granted that Brazil would be what was called the Colossus of the South, comparable to the Colossus of the North. Haiti, now one of the poorest countries in the world, was the richest colony in the world, the source of much of France's wealth, now devastated. First by France, then by the United States. Venezuela, enormous wealth, was taken over by the United States around 1920, right at the beginning of the oil age, had been a British dependency, but Woodrow Wilson kicked the British out, recognizing that control of oil was going to be important, and supported a vicious dictator, and then more or less goes on until the present. So the resources and the potential were always there, very rich. In contrast, East Asia had almost no resources. But they followed a different developmental path. In Latin America, imports were luxury goods for the rich. In East Asia, it's capital goods for development. They had state-coordinated development programs. They disregarded the Washington Consensus almost totally. Capital controls on export of capital, harsh punishments for it, pretty egalitarian societies, a lot of authoritarian, sometimes pretty harsh, but educational programs, health programs, and so on. In fact, they followed pretty much the developmental paths of the currently wealthy countries, which are radically different from the rules that are being imposed on the South. And that goes way back in history. You go back to the 17th century, the commercial and industrial centers of the world were China and India. Life expectancy in Japan was greater than in Europe. Europe was kind of like a barbarian outpost, but it had advantages, mainly in savagery. Conquered the world, imposed something like the neoliberal rules on the conquered regions. And itself, very high protectionism, a lot of state intervention, and so on. So Europe developed. The United States is a typical case, had the highest tariffs in the world, most protectionist country in the world during the period of its great development. In fact, at the latest 1950, when the United States literally had half the world's wealth, its tariffs were higher than the Latin American countries today, which are being ordered to reduce them. Massive state intervention in the economy. Economists don't talk about it much, but the current economy in the United States relies very heavily on the state sector. That's where you get your computers and the internet and your airplane traffic and transit of goods, container ships, and so on. Almost entirely comes out of the state sector, including pharmaceuticals, management techniques, and so on. Won't go on to that, but it's a strong correlation right through history. Those are the methods of development. The neoliberal methods created the third world, and in the past 30 years, they have led to disasters in Latin America and Southern Africa, the places that most rigorously adhered to them, but whereas there was growth and development in East Asia, which disregarded them, following the rules, following pretty much the model of the currently rich countries. Well, there's a chance that will begin to change. There are finally efforts inside South America, unfortunately not in Central America, which has just been pretty much devastated by the terror of the 80s particularly, But in South America, from Venezuela to Argentina, it's, I think, the most exciting place in the world. There's reactions to this. After 500 years, there's a beginning of efforts to overcome these overwhelming problems. The integration that's taking place that I just read about is one example. There's efforts of the Indian population, the indigenous population is for the first time in hundreds of years taking a really beginning in some of the countries take a very active role in their own affairs. In Bolivia, they succeeded in taking over the country, controlling their resources, Bolivia. And it's also leading to significant democratization, real democracy, in which the population participates. So take, say, Bolivia. It's the poorest country in the hemisphere, in South America. Haiti's poor. It had a real democratic election last year, of a kind that you can't imagine in the United States or in Europe, for that matter. There was mass popular participation, and people knew what the issues were. The issues were crystal clear and very important. And people didn't just participate on election day. These are things they had been struggling about for years. Actually, Cochabamba is a symbol of it. I'll come back to that. So clear issues, popular participation, ongoing efforts, elected someone from their own ranks. I won't bother to compare it to the United States. You can work it out for yourselves. But that's a real democratic election of the kind we can't imagine. In fact, in our elections, the issues are unknown. There's careful efforts to make sure that the issues are unknown to the public for good reasons. There's a tremendous gap between public opinion and public policy, so you have to keep away from issues and concentrate on imagery and delusions and so on. The elections are run by the same industries that sell toothpaste on television. You don't expect to get information from a television ad. You don't expect to get information about a candidate from debates, advertisements, and the other paraphernalia that goes along with what are called elections here. There's a lot of fuss on the left about election irregularities, like, you know, the voting machines were tampered with, didn't count the votes right, and so on. That's all accurate and of some importance. But of far more importance is the fact that elections just don't take place, not in any meaningful sense of the term election. So it doesn't matter all that much if there was some tampering. I suspect that's why the population doesn't get much exercised over it. The concern over stolen elections and vote tampering and so on is mostly an elite affair. Most of the country didn't seem to care very much. Okay, so the election was stolen. I mean, if you're flipping a coin to select a king or something, it doesn't matter much if the coin is biased. It seems to be the way most people feel about it, and there's some justification. In fact, the attitude of the public here towards the political system is very dramatic. I mean, about a third of the population in the United States, according to recent polls, believes that the Bush administration was responsible for 9/11. But they don't think it's a problem. Like, they don't think that's anything to worry about. Yeah, of course, they're all crooks and gangsters and murderers. Tell us something new, you know. It doesn't have much to do with us. That's a shocking commentary on the state of American democracy. There's a lot of talk here about, you know, we have a divided country. We have to need a unifier. Somebody will bring it back together, red and blue, and so on. It's pretty marginal. It is a divided country. It's divided between public opinion and public policy, a very sharp divide. And on issue after issue, the whole political system is well to the right of the public and public attitudes. And we know a lot about these because it's a very well-studied topic in the United States.
We'll continue with Professor Noam Chomsky's address after break.
Estais com palmos medida, é a conta menor que tiraste em vida, é a conta menor que tiraste em vida, é de tamanho, nem largo, nem fundo. É a parte que te cabe nesse latifúndio. É a parte que te cabe nesse latifúndio. Não é cova grande, é cova medida. É a terra que querias ver dividida. É a terra que querias ver dividida. É uma cova grande pra teu pouco defunto. Mas estarás mais anjo que estavas no mundo. Mas estarás mais anjo que estavas no mundo. É uma cova grande pra teu defunto.
Barbosa, Funeral of a Laborer, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we return to the address of Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, speaking last Thursday in Boston.
Just to give one last illustration, I was driving home from work the other day and torturing myself by listening to NPR, and it's kind of a masochistic streak I can't get over. Actually, someday I'm going to sue them. Sometime, once they got me so angry that I started speeding, I lost control of what I was doing, and I was stopped by a cop, and I was going like 60 miles an hour in a 30-mile zone. Maybe a basis for a civil suit if there are any lawyers around here. But they had a section on Barack Obama, the great new hope, and it was very exuberant, what a fantastic personality is, a great candidate, thousands of people coming out. And it went on for about 15 minutes of excited rhetoric. You know, there's only one thing missing. They didn't say a word about what his policies were on anything. It's kind of not, doesn't matter. You know, he's a unifier, he looks at you and he talks to you, he's a really decent guy, great background, okay. That's an election. Bolivia was radically different, and that's a very striking comparison, and it, in fact, generalizes. One of the things that's happened in Latin America in the past several decades is there has been a wave of authentic democratization, despite U.S. efforts to impede it. It's taken place. However, an unfortunate side effect of it is that as the wave of democratization increased, support for democracy remained strong in Latin America, support for the elected governments has been declining, steadily declining. There's a reasonable explanation for that that was given by an Argentine political scientist, Attilio Borón. He pointed out that the wave of democratization correlated with the neoliberal programs, which are designed to undermine democracy. I don't have time to talk about it, but every element of them is specifically designed to undermine democracy, to restrict the public arena, participation, and so on. So he concludes, I think plausibly, that it's not surprising that while the desire to have democracy remains very high, support for the elected government declines insofar as they follow the programs that are undermining democracy. Now, there are a few exceptions. The leading exception, again, Latin American opinion is also pretty carefully polled and studied, so we know a lot about it. The leading exception is Venezuela. From 1998 to the present, support for the elected government has increased sharply in pretty dramatic contrast to almost all of Latin America. There's some increases elsewhere. And in fact, Venezuela leads the continent in support for the elected government. That's probably why it's called anti-democratic and authoritarian and dictator and so on and so forth. The rhetoric here is kind of interesting. There's real, there are authoritarian tendencies, undoubtedly. But the picture of Chavez as a tin pot dictator has destroyed freedom of the press and so on, that's the standard line, also in the right-wing press in South America, and believed, in fact, completely inconsistent with the facts. I mean, take, say, freedom of the press. As you know, there was a coup in Venezuela in the year 2002, supported by the United States. The government was overthrown, taken over by Pedro Carmona. who immediately, rich businessman, who immediately dissolved Parliament, destroyed the Supreme Court, got rid of the Attorney General's office, the public defender. Every vestige of democracy was instantly demolished. U.S. strongly supported it. The Venezuelan private press, the press strongly supported it. One of the people who supported the coup was the opposition candidate in the last election. Other supporters of the coup were a group called Sumate, the group that the U.S. provides aid to for what's called democracy building. So the coup was supported by substantial part of the elite in the society, those backed by the United States, destroyed the democratic system. It was quickly overthrown by a popular uprising. The U.S. had to back off. But what's striking is that the newspapers continue to publish, still continue to attack the government. Rosales, who supported the coup, ran in the election. Sumate, which supported the coup, is functioning, the main recipient of U.S. democracy promotion funds. Just imagine that that had happened in the United States. Suppose there was a coup that overthrew the government, supported by the leading press, you know, by political figures and so on. Would the press continue to function? Would the supporter of the coup be the opposition candidate in the next election? It's unimaginable. They'd all be lined up in front of firing squads. But this is the tin pot dictator who's destroying freedom of the press. It's not the first time. But these are quite important developments. What they illustrate is a decline in the, first of all, a move towards integration, independence, and authentic democracy with mass popular movements and participation and so on, all extremely important. But also, along with it, goes a decline in the methods of domination and control. The U.S. has dominated the region for a long time with two major methods, one of them violence and the other economic strangulation, economic controls. And both of those methods are declining in efficacy. 2002 was the last effort of the United States to overthrow a government. In earlier years, it was routine. And in fact, the governments that the U.S. is now supporting, say Lula, probably would have been overthrown 40 years ago. It's not that much difference between Lula and Goulart, the Brazilian president who was overthrown by the Kennedy-instigated coup. There is a notable decline in the efficacy of violence for control. And the same is true of economic controls. The main economic controls in recent years have been the IMF, which is virtually a branch of the U.S. Treasury Department. But the countries are freeing themselves of its controls. Argentina basically told the Argentina had was the poster boy of the IMF. It was a great success story, except that it led to a total, complete crash, terrible crash. Argentina did recover, but by violating IMF rules, refusing to pay its debts, buying up what remained of the debt, and ridding ourselves of the IMF, as the president put it. They were able to do that partly with the help of Venezuela, which bought up about a third of the debt, another form of cooperation. Brazil, in its own way, moved in the same direction, freeing itself from the IMF. Bolivia is now doing it. Bolivia had been, again, a rigorous, obedient student of the IMF for about 25 years. It ended up with per capita income lower than when it started. Now they're getting rid of the IMF too, again with Venezuelan support. And as this proceeds through the IMF itself is in serious trouble. If you look at the business pages, you'll notice that its viability is in question because it's not getting the kinds of funds it used to get from the role it played in being what one of the U.S. executive director of the IMF once called it the credit community's enforcer. It's like the mafia. They're the goons who were sent in to get the payments, default and so on. But they're not getting it anymore, and their own funds are running low. They may not survive. Well, that's all of this is just one aspect of the weakening of the economic controls alongside the weakening of the controls of violence, and that's going hand in hand with the steps towards integration and independence. The U.S. has had to have a policy change. There's still a distinction between the good guys and the bad guys. The good guys happen to be governments that the U.S. probably would have overthrown 40 years ago, like Lula's Brazil. That's one of the good guys. Morales and Chavez, they're the bad guys. Well, that's the party line. You've read it over and over. In order to maintain it, it's necessary to finesse some of the facts, like, for example, the fact that when Lula was reelected in October, the good guy, his first act was to fly to Caracas to support Chavez's electoral campaign. It's the bad guy. Now, that wasn't reported in the United States, too remote from the party line. Also, Lula dedicated a Brazilian project in Venezuela, a bridge over the Orinoco River, a new development projects, and so on. That's all the wrong story. And as I mentioned, as the AP reported, Venezuela has been in the lead of trying to move towards regional integration. That's what the Chavez's Bolivian Alternatives for the Americas, ALBA, is supposed to be about. That involves efforts to develop institutions for an integrated South America. The Petroamerica is kind of an integrated plan for an integrated energy system of the kind that China is trying to initiate in East Asia, in Asia, also very worrisome to the United States. Telesur is an effort to break through the closely guarded Western media monopoly. It's a big story in itself. The University of the South, if it takes off, would be an academic center for the Americas and so on. Well, the U.S. is kind of losing control. It's not that U.S. policies change. Policy has to be adjusted. The U.S. has not given up on means of violence and economic control, but taking new forms. Training of Latin American officers by the U.S. has gone way up very sharply in the last few years, and they're being trained differently. The training is being shifted from the State Department to the Pentagon. That's of some significance. When training of Latin American officers is under State Department controls, there's at least theoretically congressional supervision of human rights violations and so on, not very many teeth in it, but at least it's sort of there.
MIT linguist and political analyst Noam Chomsky speaking in Boston several days ago. You can get a copy of today's show at our website, democracynow.org. As we end with John Mohawk, a leading scholar and spokesperson for the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy. He died in Buffalo, New York, December 12th. Mohawk was a leading advocate for the rights of indigenous people worldwide. He served as Director of Indigenous Studies at the Center for the Americas at the State University of New York, Buffalo. Mohawk was also Director of the Iroquois White Corn Project, which promoted and sold Iroquois white corn products and foods and supported contemporary indigenous farmers. John Mohawk was a columnist at Indian Country Today, and his last book was Utopian Legacies, A History of Conquest and Oppression in the Western World. John Mohawk spoke last month in New York at the Indigenous Peoples' Resistance to Economic Globalization, a celebration of victories, rights, and cultures. The teach-in was sponsored by the International Forum on Globalization and the Tebteba Foundation. John Mohawk began by talking about the Spanish conquest of the Americas and ended by discussing the domination of indigenous people in the United States. He refers to Requerimiento, a document used by the Spanish, which demanded indigenous people willingly submit to the Spanish crown or the Spanish would attack.
Racism has historically been a thing experienced by non-white people. But let's be clear about this. Two things about this. One is that is that the ideology that it's proposing is an ideology. It's basically saying, essentially, that all the non-white peoples in the world are not entitled to own whatever it is they have. And it also is making the corollary kind of proposition that the group that's in the aggressive position has a right, and that this right is undeniable. Notice that the right also has an implementation form to it, that the right has the requirement that we're going to use military force to enforce this right, and that when we think of as racism, which has always been the sort of scornful denigration of people of a different race, has its roots in what is distinct from white supremacy. I point that out because white supremacy is an ideology that can be embraced by people of color. People of color, I think we already know there are people of color in the world who agree with it. Some of them are pretty big, important Americans, as a matter of fact. Okay. So a lot of things are going to happen after this. I mean, we're going to have, when we get to the United States, we're going to have a claim of something which is called American civilization. And American civilization is going to claim to have a right to all the lands of the Indians in the United States. And, of course, the American civilization is a rationalization for a lot of bad things, things like the removal policy and things like the Indian War thing and things like the forced assimilation policy. All of those flow from an ideology of white supremacy, which is the dominant ideology of race theory in the United States in the 19th century. I point this out because it seems to me that the moment we're looking at is a proposal that peoples of the world, distinct peoples of the world, have a right to a continued existence as distinct peoples. And I point to you that the white supremacy argument offers no such rights. It doesn't offer any rights to a continued existence of distinct peoples. It doesn't offer any rights to distinct existence, a continued existence of other species, of birds, animals, plants, and whatever, fishes. It is a theory that says that one group has the absolute unhindered right to do what they need to do, to get what they want. What do they want? They want the wealth of the world. The other thing is that the requirement is still there. In fact, the requirement is embodied in the rules and thinking that give rise to the World Trade Organization. It's not that they're simply an ideology. There's an enforcement mechanism for the ideology. This is a compulsive ideology. It says that you must comply, you have to belong to this thing. Everything that you have has to come into our purvey. You have to join our system of domination and actually extinction.
John Mohawk, leading scholar and spokesperson for the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy. He died in Buffalo, New York on December 12th at the age of 61. And that does it for our broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy of this DVD or any others, they make wonderful holiday gifts. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Lee Burek. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Uri Galed is our director. A special thanks to Jeanette Ivers and Dennis Moynihan. Again, that website is democracynow.org, where you can read transcripts of our broadcast, and you can also hear and watch the video and audio podcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.